This is WBCR LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to keep the station improving and serving you, our community. On today's Farm and Garden Show with J. Allison Mascarello and Bill Taylor, we talk with Dr. Don Huber about glyphosate, Roundup, and other issues pertaining to the balance of pathogens and beneficial organisms to plants. First, some upcoming events. BerkshireGrown.org is the place to find information on all the local farmers' markets. The Great Barrington Seed Library needs a coordinator to revive this community resource. Contact the Great Barrington Public Library at 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Once again, that number is 413-528-1619, extension 6000. Now for some farmers markets. Millerton Farmers Markets are at Millerton Methodist Church, 6 Duchess Avenue, Millerton, New York. Saturdays 10 to 2, year round. Winter Farmers Markets. Hoosie Dome, also known as Housatonic Community Center, 1064 Main Street, Housatonic, Mass., 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays as follows: February 15th, March 15th, April 19th. Vendors offer an abundance of locally grown food, including fresh greens, winter squash, root crops, apples, meat, cheese, jam, honey and maple syrup, baked goods, and more. Local artists and crafters round out the market offerings, and each market features live music. Markets welcome SNAP and HIP. SNAP users receive a market match of up to $30 per market, and each market includes vendors with HIP eligible products, providing SNAP shoppers with an immediate reimbursement for benefit dollars spent on fresh fruits and vegetables. Carrots, apples, locally roasted coffee, sharp cheese, and fresh bread. The Winter Pittsfield Farmers Market welcomes in farmers and artisans together. You may meet a collective of young farmers who plow by horsepower. You may sample winter squash or hot cider. The year-round market is teen-led through Roots Rising, a program that helps teens to work at farms and food pantries throughout the Berkshires and supports crews working on local farms and the crew who runs the market in all seasons. They are working toward building a food truck crew as well. From November to April, the Pittsfield Winter Market runs monthly at the Zion Lutheran Church next to the Pittsfield Common. Saturdays, February and March 8th, April 12th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Information on these markets can be found at berkshiregrown.org. Sheffield Winter Farmers Market will be held second Saturdays through March from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Dewey Hall, 91 Main Street in Sheffield, February 8th and March 8th. Vendor applications and other information at sheffieldfarmersmarket.org. Berkshire Botanical Garden in Stockbridge offers many classes on gardening, horticulture, cooking, and other garden-related topics, even in winter. The website berkshirebotanical.org/events has listings. Phone is 413-298-3926, and email is info@berkshirebotanical.org. Now we're going to talk about our wonderful guest today. Don Huber is a professor emeritus of plant pathology at Purdue University. He received BS and MS degrees from the University of Idaho, a PhD from Michigan State University, and is a graduate of the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College and Industrial College of the Armed Forces. He was serial pathologist at the University of Idaho for 8 years before joining the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology at Purdue University in 1971. His agricultural research the past 50 years has focused on the epidemiology and control of soil-borne plant pathogens with emphasis on microbial ecology, cultural and biological controls, and physiology of host-parasite relationships. Research also includes nitrogen metabolism, micronutrient research. He is internationally recognized for his expertise in the development of nitrification inhibitors to improve the efficiency of N fertilizers, interactions of the form of nitrogen, manganese, and other nutrients in disease, herbicide-nutrient disease interactions, and techniques for rapid microbial identification and cultural control of plant diseases. We're delighted to be having Dr. Don Huber, who's a professor emeritus of plant pathology at Purdue University. How did you first get involved in epidemiology and control of pathogens?
Well, I became interested growing up on a dairy farm in Arizona and Idaho. Became interested in why we were seeing such a big difference in our different fields that followed different crops in the rotation, to find out why we had that big a difference in the severity of disease. We had the same soils, just because we had a different sequence in the crops, we would see quite a large effect on the subsequent diseases on a following crop. And so, just curiosity, I got started when I started on my master's. Dr. Finley asked me what I'd like to really study and use as a focus point for my research. And I said, well, I'd like to answer that question. It'd been bugging me for a long time. And he said, sounds great. I've had the same question on my mind, but he said, you have to remember when you're working with soil-borne diseases that all of your accomplishments are going to be recognized posthumously and not during your lifetime. So good luck.
Well, that's good that it didn't deter you.
You've talked a lot about glyphosate, but are there other issues that would be as compelling as glyphosate?
Well, certainly paraquat, atrazine, glufosinate, all of those serious chemicals that we're using, and we're using them quite indiscriminately and in extremely large quantities, should all be a concern to everybody. There are many issues, but glyphosate epitomizes all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it as a classic because it's reached an extremely serious concern for us, both because of its direct effects, but also its indirect effects and the tremendous amount of it that's accumulated in our environment. So it's a very difficult compound to degrade. In that lack of degradation, we see all of the adverse effects, not just on one crop or one environment, but essentially across the entire environmental system that we live in.
Mm-hmm. So what's the chemical composition and how does it act? And then I also want to talk about the formulation Roundup, which has activators or synergists. If you look up Dr. Don Huber glyphosate on YouTube, you can find some great talks.
Oh yeah, there's some wonderful talks. But
with slides that we're not able to show on the radio.
It's a relatively simple compound, invented in 1957. It was patented in 1964 as a mineral chelator, a broad-spectrum mineral chelator for cations. It was used at the time to clean steam pipes and boilers because it could grab onto the calcium and magnesium and iron. And when you have a chelator, it grabs onto another element and changes the physical characteristics so that you could descale your boiler and that quite nicely with glyphosate. In 1974, it was patented by Monsanto as a broad-spectrum herbicide that killed almost all vegetation. The only living things that escaped were mammals, according to them, because it could never be toxic, because glyphosate was a very specific chemical that only inhibited the EPSPS enzyme at the start of the shikimate pathway. Well, the problem is that it's a very broad-spectrum chelator that inhibits 291 known enzymes, so it's not specific for the EPS enzyme, but that enzyme, again, doesn't occur in mammal cells, but it is very important in the life cycle of about half of our gut microbiome, so that although we don't have the shikimate pathway in our own cells, the comment to the EPA that they don't need to do the safety testing because it could never be toxic to mammals is very false. Because if you have gut dysbiosis, wipe out a half of your beneficial microbes in the gut, you're not going to be nutritionally fed. And also, a lot of those other hormones and vitamins aren't going to be produced for you. So it's a very critical component or toxicant to your beneficial organisms. It was patented then in 2002 by Monsanto as a broad spectrum antibiotic. It's probably the broadest spectrum antibiotic that we know of. And when you get resistance to glyphosate as an antibiotic, get organisms resistant to it, then you'll find that they're also resistant to all of our other antibiotics. So
Wow.
glyphosate has a lot of different hats that are going around there to be concerned about, because the organisms that it doesn't inhibit are our pathogens, Listeria, Salmonella, Clostridium, E. coli. Those pathogens are resistant to glyphosate, but all of the organisms that would normally control them in nature are very sensitive to it, so that we have large recalls of eggs or poultry products or cantaloupes and lettuce because of the lack of competition and natural biological control of those pathogens that then run rampant in that somewhat modified environment, because of the glyphosate's antibiotic activity against the beneficial organism.
Wow, that is serious amount of damage that it does. I'm getting nauseous just knowing this.
And then Roundup is a common formulation. Is there anything added to that that changes the properties or that makes it more virulent?
The EPA doesn't look at formulation, it only looks at quote unquote active ingredients, so that even if they did require testing for safety, they would only require it on the glyphosate entity, not on the full formulation. Look at the label on the bottle, and it says, well, it's 2.5% glyphosate, and it'll give a couple of other ingredients, but they don't tell you what that other 93% of the bottle is. One of those components in the Roundup product, even Roundup alone, without your surfactants and other materials, other adjuvants, contains nitrosamines. Those are the tobacco carcinogens and very difficult to remove. They're a product of the manufacturing process where they make the glyphosate, but you have well-recognized carcinogen along with glyphosate, so that when you look at the label, it only tells you about 6% of the active ingredients, and certainly doesn't list a lot of the severe toxicants that go along with that formulation.
So there have been some studies done on those or not, on those other things, independent studies, because obviously Monsanto wasn't required to study those.
Yes, Meissengi and Cerullini and various SAMcell, number of independent scientists have looked at the toxicity of those other components and find that they're anywhere from 100 to 1,000 times more toxic than the glyphosate itself. Most of them look for toxicity. They're looking for acute toxicity, LD50 type of data. How much does it take to kill an organism in a very short period of time? Glyphosate, because of its broad spectrum chelating activity, is a chronic toxin, not an acute toxin. So that its toxicity accumulates, it's systemic, water soluble, accumulates in the body and also in the plant, also in soils. So that in some of our soils, we're finding 20 or 30 years of glyphosate still sitting there in the soil. It may be chelated and detoxified, but it's sitting there just waiting for something like phosphorus fertilizer to come along and break that chelation and release an active herbicide again, because it's a very difficult compound to degrade.
Why do clay soil and acid soils keep it from being degraded?
Glyphosate's a synthetic amino acid, the simplest amino acid, glycine, and we haven't had hundreds of years for organisms to adapt and develop the ability to degrade it. There are quite a few organisms that will decarboxylate or will take off one carbon atom and change it from the glyphosate molecule to the AMPA molecule. But that's where it stays. And AMPA, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, is 1.5 times more toxic than the glyphosate itself. So when you degrade to AMPA, you still have an even more toxic product. And the limiting factor is the carbon phosphate lyase. If it was a phosphate, there would be many organisms that could degrade it, but the carbon phosphate lyase enzyme required to break glyphosate down further is the missing link for degradation.
Wow.
There's so much to think about here. How long does the chelation property remove
Mineral elements from access? I think you said for the life of an annual plant, but I'm wondering if perennials can recover from application. Or does it remove those elements for a very long time, like years?
the half-life of glyphosate is reported as 1.5 to 22 years, depending on your soil type and your soil pH primarily. However, if you get into our heavier silt loam soils or clay loam soils, the glyphosate gets trapped between the clay lattice structures and it can become a forever chemical. It's there just building up because the organisms that would degrade it if they were there don't have ready access to it, and it's tightly bound in the chelation relationship with the minerals, so that it's not just detoxified, but it's also tying up a lot of our essential trace elements. Glyphosate chelates with 10 of our 18 essential nutrients, so that it's a very broad spectrum tie-up of those nutrients. I mentioned that phosphate fertilizer can break that chelation and desorb the glyphosate from the soil particles because phosphorus and glyphosate have the same binding sites in soil. And when it's desorbed or released in that situation where phosphorus will grab onto the binding site and desorb or release the glyphosate back into the environment, it forms a very active herbicide that is toxic to plants. We had a situation last year where the grower and his consultants did everything right, but when they put their phosphate fertilizer on to optimize the nutrition for that element, phosphorus is also systemic in the plant, goes out through the root exudates into the soil and desorbs that accumulated glyphosate. They went from a beautiful crop anticipating a healthy yield, and when they harvested, they had rather than 70 bushel, they had 7 bushel. It went from that beautiful green to yellow to dead in 10 days because of the activity of that stored up glyphosate that then was desorbed and available to kill the plant. Glyphosate's more toxic from root uptake than it is even from the foliage, so it doesn't take as much, but as little as 11 or 12 grams per acre. And we're commonly putting out 450 grams per acre, but as little as 11 to 12 grams per acre will inhibit the root uptake of iron, manganese, and zinc, and also prevent the translocation of iron and manganese then to the rest of the plant for use in that process. So that you have severe nutrient deficiencies from uptake of very small amounts. It may not kill the plant totally, but it certainly stresses it, put it under a severe nutrient deficiency so that it's no longer able to effectively capture the sun's energy and store it as sugar through photosynthesis and other reactions there.
Now, we've had Dr. James White talk about rhizophagy, in which the plant roots actually take the microbes in. And I'm wondering if the fact that it acts as an antibiotic affects some of those cycles of what's going on in the roots and maybe why it's so much more effective in harming the plant through the roots rather than through the leaves.
Glyphosate disrupts that entire process in two ways. One, by direct attack as an antibiotic against the organisms that are involved in that rhizophagy aspect, but also in root growth. So that you'll notice with the glyphosate that you have a modified root growth because of chelation, immobilization of manganese and calcium and other elements that are required for that grow those roots to start with. So that whole system is markedly damaged in the environment. When you have a strong chelator, and especially one that's a chelator, but also an antibiotic against those beneficial organisms.
Wow.
About 20% of the glyphosate that's applied to the plant actually moves down and moves out into the roots. You read on the glyphosate bottle and it says, gets the roots. Well, it does. It moves down into the roots, compromises the disease resistance by shutting down the chelate and other pathways. When it chelates those minerals, then you don't have the environment for that process or the organism still functional and minerals available for them with glyphosate.
Wow. So let's talk about how it's used.
It's used extensively as a weed killer or a plant killer. That would be its primary use, even though it's an antibiotic. It's not used for that manner generally. If you got the levels up to kill parasites, you'd also kill the plants. So we apply about a quarter of a billion pounds of glyphosate a year now, and that's just in agriculture. We apply another quarter of a billion pounds for parks and recreation and home gardens, and especially for forest spraying. So that there's half a billion pounds of glyphosate that's going out every year. Only a limited amount of that is really degraded or decomposed, so that we have a lot of material that we're sitting on that can be desorbed and reactivated, and an extreme time bomb for us now. In the past, we've relied on filter strips and mineral chelation to detoxify glyphosate. Those are failing us now, so you see the eutrophication of our lakes and streams, even though we may have a 200 or 300 foot filter strip around them.
So what's a filter strip?
Filter strip is just an area around our lakes and streams that no chemical is applied to, so that any chemical runoff would be caught in that area, so we call it a filter strip. We've assumed, because the glyphosate and other chemicals haven't gotten into our waterways where we've had those filter strips, we've assumed that it's just degraded in those areas. It moves into them. It's captured by the calcium and magnesium and iron and other cations so that it doesn't move through them, and that would leave them there in a situation where they could be degraded. The problem, as I mentioned before, on degrading is that there are not a lot of organisms in the environment that can break it down truly. So what we've done now, where we see eutrophication and that taking place, is we've saturated those filter strips with glyphosate so that there aren't any free cations for it to chelate, to be grabbed onto and immobilized. So we're seeing now that glyphosate itself is moving right through the filter strips, killing the competition, and we've lost that control mechanism.
Wow. So I know it's used for invasive plant control, which I think is a crazy fad. We just call something invasive, just like we call people invasive. Also drying down plants for harvest. And then, of course, home use of it. You want to get the weeds out of your path. I don't want to, but a lot of people do.
If you want to see the impact of invasive weed control, aquatic weed control, all we have to do is look at the situation in 2008 in the Yakima Valley, where you have three counties. You've got Yakima, Benton, and Hamilton counties, where the three rivers that are going through those areas all were infested with invasive weeds. And so they started dumping Rodeo, which is a glyphosate herbicide registered by EPA for water application. They started dumping glyphosate herbicide in to control those invasive weeds, and within 2 years had an 8,000% increase in anencephaly in the children, because those three rivers provided the drinking water and irrigation water for the entire valley. Anencephaly is where the brain doesn't fully develop. Children are usually stillborn. If you get to hold your child, it's usually 24 or 48 hours before it dies. The problem there was the glyphosate levels, even though they were still reportedly well below what the EPA says is safe. It's an endocrine hormone disrupting chemical, so that the developmental process in the fetus was inhibited, and had a massive outpouring of anencephaly and miscarriage and stillbirths as a result of it.
Wow, there's just so much to this. Let's do a little contact information. How can people find out more about your work?
Well, there are some YouTube or other presentations that I've made on the internet. I don't have a website. There's an international conference or symposium on pesticide use in Africa. The proceedings of that symposium have been published now. I'm a co-author with Charlie Wilson on it, or putting it all together. The title is Synthetic Pesticide Use in Africa, Impact on People, Animals, and the Environment. Tremendous resource as far as not just glyphosate, but other toxins, other pesticide products that are involved here. Most of the speakers were from the Western countries, Europe and US and Canada and South America, and then those from Africa also. It would be a recommended resource.
And how do people find that?
That can be, it's published by CRC Press or Taylor and Francis, and they can get that on Amazon and other bookstores carrying it.
So it's synthetic
pesticide use in Africa.
Use in Africa, okay.
Impact on people, animals, and the environment.
It would be Don Huber and
Charles L. Wilson.
And then you're Don Huber, H-U-B-E-R. And if you just look up Dr. Don Huber, glyphosate, YouTube, things from 10 years ago and 5 years ago and just last year, 2024.
We just had a paper published in November titled Saga of Soggy Sauerkraut. It'll be a free download from the internet, and it's a situation where sauerkraut company lost $1 million worth of organic sauerkraut because of contamination of the chicken manure that was used as the fertilizer for the organic cabbage going into the sauerkraut.
Wow.
Initially, the company thought it was a problem in the fermenting process, contamination or of other organisms, but we did the analysis and their biology was all proper, correct. It finally boiled down to the fact that the glyphosate contamination of the manure used as nutrients for the cabbage was contaminated with glyphosate, and then that prevented secondary cell wall formation in the cabbage that looked good going into the fermenter, but when they opened up those 100-ton vats of sauerkraut, it was more like applesauce than it was that beautiful product that they were proud of producing in the program. That's a free download to get an idea of some of the ways that glyphosate can contaminate the products. There wasn't any glyphosate in the cabbage or in the sauerkraut because the organisms that degrade the glyphosate are the same ones that do the fermenting to make the sauerkraut. So it's kind of a natural probiotic, if you want to look at it that way, as far as the glyphosate, but the damage from the glyphosate was in the cabbage and the structural components that were not produced. Those were produced through the shikimate pathway.
So that sauerkraut story, there's probably plenty of other places that glyphosate gets into us and into food and into animals. And let's talk a little bit about some of those effects.
When it's used as a desiccant or a harvest aid to ripen up the crop faster, glyphosate's a systemic compound that will actually, even though it looks like the plant may be dying, glyphosate will move across the membranes and enter the reproductive structures. It's also accumulating in the growth points on the plant, the roots and the leaves. All of those are potential food sources for us or for our animals. And that's where we find the highest accumulation of glyphosate. But we find it in parks and recreation areas. That's why you see a lot of dogs that go through parks that are sprayed with glyphosate will develop mammary cancer, and that's becoming a more prevalent situation for our pets. If you're close to a forested area that's sprayed, the drift levels there are very serious health hazards for any people that are there or that use the water from those forested areas that have been sprayed. They do that to take the browse out and the broadleaf tree species because they want the conifers, and conifers are more tolerant of glyphosate than the hardwoods. So a lot of our forests are sprayed with glyphosate, sometimes a number of times. Contamination, especially, is prevalent in our genetically engineered crops or food from our engineered crops because 85% of them are engineered to tolerate glyphosate or glufosinate or paraquat, dicamba, and the other herbicides. So that when they're sprayed directly on that crop, those compounds are all systemic, move into the crop. Then we're consequently exposed to them as a result of contamination of our food products. It's not something you can wash off because it's internal inside the plant and accumulates then in the plant. It's going to be quite persistent in those areas. And when we digest those foods, we liberate the toxin and as a chelator. There's nothing in a genetically engineered plant that does anything to the glyphosate or paraquat or diquat or Q4D that they're engineered to tolerate. It only provides an alternative pathway so that they're not killed by the herbicide.
So it's still there to react with anything else, like our gut microbiome or anything else in your.
Right. When we develop a non-desiccant type of a ripening process for sugarcane, within 6 hours after we'd applied the glyphosate to the foliage of those 12-foot-high stalks, we had more than 100 times the amount of glyphosate in those stalks of the sugarcane plants than would be required to chelate all of the inbound cations that were in the plant. So it's very potent, very rapid movement in the plant. That phosphite part of the molecule is what gives it the ability to systemically move through the plant and then accumulate in it also in those areas where you have high mineral content, like the bran on your wheat or barley or oats, will be 4 to 10 times higher level of glyphosate accumulation than you would find in the inside of the grain. So when the European Union wanted to emphasize the need to consume whole wheat bread, they're doing it because that's where the higher concentration of minerals are. And then they realize that that's also where the highest concentration of the glyphosate is, and had to withdraw that recommendation because of the increased level of glyphosate in those products.
So you're saying they went more back to white bread because the whole grain bread in that case was dangerous. I'm wondering if that's true everywhere. Many of us listening try to buy organic grains. I know that they sometimes drift from a non-organic farm next door. I'm assuming they can't use the dry down treatment to kill the plant to facilitate harvest on organic crops, but I'm just wondering how safe organic is.
Well, your organic probably won't be completely free of glyphosate. Many of them are, just because we now see a lot of contamination in the air and water sources, and also in our fertilizer sources. With
Right.
organic, you're not using the regular fertilizers, but unless the manure is coming from an organic poultry or dairy or that type of thing, the manure is just going to reflect the glyphosate that's in the feed. And so you have that feed to feces to food problem as far as glyphosate contamination. But the organic is definitely much lower, anywhere from 160 to 1,000 times lower and glyphosate than the non-organic version of that food. So Quaker Oats has been criticized for high levels in their Cheerios and their oatmeal. So 2 years ago, they had announced to their growers that they wouldn't purchase any oats that had been desiccated by glyphosate, where they'd sprayed the glyphosate on the oats just before harvest. That's had a great effect in reducing the levels that are in some of those commodities and products that are made from the oats. Actually, the highest level that Tony Mitra found in Canada in his analyses, the highest level of residual glyphosate was in garbanzo beans, very healthy product. We advertise because it's an excellent accumulator of a lot of the essential minerals that we need. It's also a product that is dried down at a time when the glyphosate's applied. You still have very active metabolic tissues in the plant for it to move into and to accumulate.
Because you're drying down the plant, it's still actively growing and taking glyphosate and other things in. It's a reason to avoid that. There's a lot of other questions in terms of health, endocrine disruption and gender dysphoria. And we can mention that. And then also autism and fertility effects, both humans and other animals.
Both of those situations are very definitely damaged by glyphosate. Glyphosate's an endocrine hormone disruptor, a tenth of a part per billion. So about a drop of glyphosate in three Olympic swimming pools, I think, is about the level that it's still a very active endocrine hormone disruptor. So that gets into your mental chemicals and those materials. It's gone, a lot of the precursors for those chemicals and the actual chemicals themselves are manufactured in the gut. So that anything that disrupts the gut can disrupt the endocrine hormone system and resistance to diseases, the whole system. It's an extremely broad spectrum activity for a chemical, considered a unique chemical. Review on it, they made the comment that it would be 100 years before a chemical with as broad spectrum activity as glyphosate would probably be invented. Infertility, of course, in the last 5 years, our sperm counts have gone down 59% in the Western world, so that we're actually an endangered species as far as our ability to persist and survive from a reproduction standpoint. It's a very serious problem, and usually even in vitro fertilization, it doesn't compensate for the deficiency and the malformation of sperm and the small numbers of sperm that are frequently produced now.
We talked about the problems of overpopulation, but this could go the opposite way.
Well, most of the Western world is decreasing in population. You look at Japan, it's been trying to increase its population since 1972, and nothing has worked. Their tax incentives, their psychological incentives, and everything else, none of them have been able, once they've reached the zero population growth, have been able to reverse that trend. What France did was just open up the borders for immigration and try and keep a population that keeps the country moving. We have to naturalize 1.5 million foreigners every year just to make system going, because our fertility rate's down to about 1.3 now. It takes 2.3 to maintain a zero population. So we have to have immigration, and we accept that legally. We have our acceptance levels for immigration to provide that, but it's a major impact. We're a long ways from what the carrying capacity of the earth would be. The Council on Agricultural Science and Technology said even with our current technologies, the Earth could support quite easily 15 billion people.
I'll have a little debate on that, because so many other animals and other species are suffering and are going extinct and losing habitat. And I know some of that disruption and extinction is probably due to toxic chemicals. Some of it's simply due to us using most of the land. We could probably have 15 billion people, but what kind of planet would that be? But we can disagree on that. The bigger issue I think you're talking about is the effect of it on fertility.
We're being depopulated quite seriously now.
Yeah. So, what are some things we can do? I mean, we can talk about antibiotic resistance, cancers, Alzheimer's, Crohn's, irritable bowel. I think you mentioned the prion diseases too. We can talk on that briefly, but I want to talk about maybe what we could do. So let's keep going.
I think the main thing is look at all the alternative means of weed control. That's where a lot of our heavy contamination comes from. 50 years ago, we didn't have glyphosate and glufosinate and those chemicals. Those are all very recent. Farmers will tell you that they can't farm without glyphosate, but we did it quite successfully 50 years ago. And we have a lot of tools in this production program, and really farming is just managing the ecology. But there are a lot of different tools that we can use to manage that ecology rather than having it all focused on the exorbitant use of just one chemical and the exposures that come from that. We can, again, looking at organic production versus regular, or the newer approach, which takes us back more to what we were doing in 50 years ago, is the regenerative agriculture. We have cover cropping and some crop rotation and a little bit of tillage and a few things that we can do that make a big impact as far as our chemical exposures.
As long as the farmers don't terminate the cover crop with glyphosate, as long as they terminate it by a flail mower or digging it in or something. Yeah.
Crimping. Yeah, if
Crimping.
you grow a cover crop and terminate it with glyphosate or paraquat or those things, you've just undone everything that that cover crop was trying to do for you.
Exactly.
There are other ways to do that, and that's the thing. Rodale Institute has done a lot of research, other groups that have also developed other ways to manage that ecology without the chemical damage. So it's a matter of desire or willpower, and sometimes glyphosate's the easiest way, but not necessarily the best, especially in the long-term production standpoint as being stewards of the soil.
And I've seen the idea that invasive plants are sometimes what come in when we disturb the environment along a roadside. The invasive plants are there and they may not even go into the forest, but people get all up in arms and just want to spray it. Maybe even just not overreacting to plants moving around, which is really what invasive plants is. Why did weed allergies increase so much around the year 2006? There was something that happened in 2006, and I think after that, weed allergies increased.
Well, that's directly related. You see the epidemiological curve for celiac and gluten intolerance is identical with the increased exposure to glyphosate. In 2005, actually, EPA approved the desiccation use of glyphosate for many of our crops, pulses as well as cereals. So, as desiccation practices became popular, and that's because we had the introduction of genetically engineered plants. 2006 was Roundup Ready soybeans, and then Roundup Ready corn, and we have Roundup Ready canola and alfalfa and cotton. And now the glyphosate just keeps getting applied, and it's gone up 15-fold with the GMO crops from what it was before. And with the glyphosate, a lot of our gluten intolerance is toxicity of glyphosate, allergenicity to it, rather than intolerance for the gluten. It's just that the two are tightly bound in the products, and you can't remove the glyphosate easily because it's systemic in the plant, not something you can wash off or even peel off. It's going to still be in that product. 2006 was the introduction of GMOs. They were quickly adopted, and that epidemiological curve for celiac and gluten intolerance is identical with our exposure to glyphosate. And it's not just celiac, but we have 32 diseases, cancers, Alzheimer's, autism, irritated bowel, all of those diseases, 32 that are approaching epidemic proportions, all have a very high correlation with the exposure to glyphosate.
Wow, yeah.
If we just look at autism alone, at the direct correlation that you have with autism and glyphosate. You see, those alone should be extremely disturbing for us. Dr. Stephanie Seneff has spent a lot of her career on the correlations between the environmental factors and autism. Dr. Michelle Perro, or a whole group of independent scientists that have demonstrated the toxicity and the damage that's done by that. But with autism, if the projections of our current epidemiological patterns hold true, by 2032, one out of two children will be autistic. We don't have the medical capabilities right now, the physical facilities and that, to take care of the 1 in 38 autistic children that are in our society right now. So that 1 in 2 is totally overwhelming for us. And if we don't take some action now to minimize that exposure to those various factors, not just one, but we need to move in all of those factors in order to reverse that trend. When you think that in 1970, 1 in 10,000 children were autistic, now we're down to 1 in 38, a higher population in the male children than in the female, but both of them, very disturbing data that we have in those.
Now, some people say that, oh, we weren't measuring it back then, and now we're measuring it. What do you say to those criticisms?
No, we may not have measured it back in 1970, but you can't argue with the data that at least something since 2005 changed. So that you look at the epidemiological pattern there and you see that extreme increase in incidence of these diseases that we've been monitoring the same pretty much from that time on, even before. So it's not a matter of diagnosis, it's a matter of reality that we have those increases in the severity of those diseases, those conditions.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering if there's anything that Big Pharma and Big Ag are going to allow to change with this chemical agriculture situation. I know there are people doing the right thing, in my opinion, that are growing biologically or organically or real organically or regeneratively. They're all different words being thrown around. But I'm just wondering what your thought is and on what options there are besides eating organic.
Growing your own food or purchasing your food from a farmer that you know is avoiding most of those chemicals. Prevention is certainly the first line of defense on it, and we can't prevent all of the exposure, but we can certainly minimize the exposure. Clean water, clean soils. We have a study going on right now with soils, fields that hadn't had any application of glyphosate for 25 years, and yet were contaminated because the manure that came in had three-fourths of a full dose of glyphosate on it to contaminate those soils. And so to minimize the exposure and prevent it wherever we can is certainly one of the main approaches that we have to start looking at. Alternative chemicals, non-persistent, non-systemic chemicals, getting back to the contact on some of the other ecological approaches that we see with the regenerative ag programs are essential for us to, again, reduce the exposure levels to these chemicals. And forest spraying is a major use. If they're going to use chemicals, then they need to be using non-persistent and non-systemic type of chemicals there. There are ecologically favorable herbicides that are being developed and have been developed that could be used. They're not as cheap as glyphosate, but I don't know how you measure the impact of an autistic child or the impact of cancer that not only is a challenge for the adult population, but also now also for our children and adult and younger adults. So we're seeing those diseases also explode as far as the incidence and changing the demographic structure of the society. There's no question in my mind that most of these chemicals are the major contributing factor for the change in society.
So there's so much that needs to change. I think we went over this a little bit. You mentioned that there's some things that can degrade glyphosate, but it sounds like they can't really keep up with the level of glyphosate being dumped. Are there any ways to remediate the soil in areas where there has been glyphosate buildup?
Well, in studies that we've had going on, I mentioned the soggy sauerkraut paper, report some of those, but it's a matter of introducing the organisms that have the capability that are also, they not only have to have the capability to degrade glyphosate, but they also have to have the ability to be compatible with the normal microflora that's in those soil, in our soils. If they're not compatible there, they're not going to be able to establish and do the job that we want them to do. It'd be kind of like, as I mentioned other times, that kind of like trying to take a rival gang into Chicago and think you're going to be the winner. These organisms have their own ecological niche that is needed, and a lot of the products now that have been developed recently, the Paleo Power and raw sauerkraut juice and a number of those things that can be used to introduce the organisms into the soil. We found that within 6 or 7 months, we had 80% of the glyphosate that was residual in the soil there fully degraded.
Wow.
We weren't just detoxifying it and letting it accumulate like we've been in the past, but we actually saw that removal of the glyphosate from the soil, and something that is really exciting to see happening. It's a matter of introducing the organisms, the lactobacillus and other organisms that are capable of degrading glyphosate that have that carbon phosphate lyase enzyme activity. It's actually much, much greater degradation than I would have anticipated in that shorter period of time.
So is there any
Or
way people can get these things? And again, you have to have the right environment for them to function.
yes, well, they've worked in most soils. They haven't been tested in a lot of them, but Paleobiotica Company has an eight organism cocktail, biological cocktail that they've developed that degrades glyphosate by all three of the known mechanisms, so that it's very effective, very compatible with the soil microflora. So you look at it a year or so after it's been applied initially and working very effectively for you, but the population is still present in the soil and it's still working. There are other groups that have developed biological cocktails also with these organisms. That's the one that we used in the study on the soggy sauerkraut to degrade. But there are other companies that have products available. Biomineral Technologies is another company. There are just a number of them that are recognizing the need, and products are being developed. Necessity is the mother of invention, and we
Right.
have the need for them. And so just the raw sauerkraut juice has been very effective, and at rates of 10 to 15 gallons per acre is manageable, so your transportation costs can stretch a little further from some of the fermentation facilities where it's a waste product. But I think that's, and so many of our soils that we have of almost 20 years or 30 years full accumulation that we can account for when we analyze for the glyphosate. It's necessary for us to really look at degradation rather than just tying it up with by adding more lime or more gypsum or more cations to tie it up. We're just kicking the can down the road
Right.
with those practices and need to degrade it.
Well, it's been great having you on the show. Is there anything we didn't ask that you wish we had?
Well, we talk about how great glyphosate is for weed control, and it's been a powerful tool for us for that aspect. But we haven't considered what happens when you have resistant weeds. That's a growing problem with glyphosate. So, as one of our weed scientists at Purdue did the study, and he said it's costing us $50 an acre more to control our weeds now using the glyphosate than it used to with just the old conventional herbicides. And that's because the weeds are tougher, they're harder to kill when they have resistance to the glyphosate, and That's an added cost factor that more than offsets the limited benefits that we now get from the glyphosate. We should really look at the health costs, the environmental costs, and our increasing production costs in all three areas, and evaluate the folly in maintaining the use of some of these products that have such a severe impact on our own health and population and ability to survive.
Right, and we didn't even talk about the effect on animals. You're talking about the microcephaly in humans and the same thing with pigs and other animals. Just want to thank you for being on the show and illuminating our listeners about glyphosate and how it works and all the different effects that it has. And I'm sure there are other agricultural chemicals. So you want to look up Dr. Don Huber. You can look up YouTube presentations that he's made. And we mentioned some papers earlier. And anything else before we finish?
Well, just thank you for the opportunity to share about 50 years of my research and many others. Appreciate your spreading the word and getting the word out so that we can respond and make the changes that we need to make.
Thank you so much.
Best wishes to you.
You too. Thanks. Here are some excerpts from Regenerate, Heal, Cool, a piece that I wrote about monoculture farming, contrasting it with regenerative or healthy soil farming. Philippe Troyot conducting, J. Allison Moscariello vocals, John Romeri flute, Pascal Archer clarinet, Gina Kufari bassoon, Artie Dibble viola, Andrew O'Connor bass, and Yifei Tzu piano.
Thank you. Once again, we interviewed Dr. Don Huber, Professor Emeritus at Purdue University. If you web search Dr. Don Huber, glyphosate, YouTube, you'll be able to find some of his talks. This is WBCR-LP Great Barrington, Berkshire Community Radio, broadcasting at 97.7 FM and streaming at berkshireradio.org, where you can also make a donation to support the station. Thank you for listening.